It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from a young person's musical performance group from Wisconsin that's been touring the state all summer. First, we're getting the latest news from on the ground in Missouri. Governor Jay Nixon ordered the National Guard to Ferguson because of continued violent protests. Earlier this month, a white police officer shot and killed an unarmed black teenager named Michael Brown in the predominantly black city on the outskirts of St. Louis. Last night and early this morning, some protesters shot at police, looted businesses, and threw Molotov cocktails. Protesters have come up against a heavy police presence, causing nightly clashes of violence. Governor Nixon's office said there were what he called pre-planned acts of aggression in his request for the National Guard. Here to give us an update on what's happening in Ferguson is Jason Rosenbaum. He's a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jason, what's the mood like in Ferguson now after what's being called the worst night of violence?
Well, I was there earlier this morning, and it was relatively calm. Throughout the afternoon, I think there's been bits and pieces of activity. Primarily, the biggest development besides the National Guard situation was the unveiling of the private autopsy commissioned by Brown's family. I think generally, though, people are just kind of waiting and seeing. Last night was such an eruption of violence and discord that I think people are just hoping that, you know, tonight is a little bit more peaceful and quiet, though who knows really what the National Guard's presence will have on the protesters.
Now, you mentioned the autopsy results are in. This is from an autopsy requested by Brown's family. You also said protesters are waiting and seeing. What are they waiting for?
Well, I think that they're waiting and seeing to see if the officer that shot Michael Brown, Darren Wilson, ends up getting indicted or not. And that I think that in general, they want very quick action. They want to see him arrested. They want to see him put on trial very quickly. But in reality, the state and federal investigations that are going forward right now, they're going to take some time to complete. They have to get all the evidence together. They have to make sure they interview as many witnesses as possible. And I think as long as there's this gap between a decision on that and, you know, the time passes since Brown's death, it's just going to make people kind of more anxious and wondering what sort of conclusion is going to come from this entire situation.
Now, as far as the autopsy results go, what have we learned?
We learned that Brown was shot 6 times, including twice in the head. We learned that gunpowder residue was not found on Brown, which means that he likely was not shot from close range. It was revealed that from the person that did the autopsy, Michael Bodden, that some of the wounds, if they had just been by themselves in the arm and elsewhere on his body, may not have proved fatal. But when he was shot near the top of the head, that proved to be the wound that ended up killing Brown. I think that, you know, he stressed that it was a preliminary autopsy and he didn't have everything at his disposal that the state and federal entities that are doing separate autopsies had, like, for example, Brown's clothing. But for some in the audience, and there were at least, I think, 12 or 15 or 20 people who were watching this press conference, they saw this autopsy as more evidence that, you know, they wanted a quick decision on whether to indict Officer Wilson or not. And, you know, I think it just kind of confirmed what they had already believed.
Another finding, according to some sources, is that Brown was shot from the front, not from behind. How is that evidence being digested?
Well, you know, that, I think, evidence is kind of one of the key takeaways there. I think that there had been some initial reports that people thought he was shot from the back. One of the people that helped with the autopsy noted that it's possible that he was walking away and then maybe turned around and the bullet struck his arm kind of in the motion of turning. But again, this autopsy doesn't necessarily tell exactly what happened. That kind of will be determined with the confluence of of witness testimony and just other evidence that comes forward. It just basically provides some key facts, like how many times Brown was shot, which shot likely killed him, whether or not he was shot at close range, and just, you know, as you mentioned, where was he shot from? And being shot from the front, I think, gives some indication, but it doesn't give a definitive indication on exactly what happened.
On Huffington Post, there were some who were wondering whether this was an execution-style shooting.
I have not read that. I think some people have used that term. And by some people, I mean the people who are in Ferguson protesting and really kind of mobilizing after Brown's death. Again, it's probably important to note, as I mentioned before, that it's a preliminary autopsy done independently, and it will kind of be determined over time through these investigations whether or not that type of determination is true. But I don't think that all the facts are there to determine that yet.
So last night, police used tear gas, and protesters reportedly used Molotov cocktails. And news sites are reporting that children and families were there and were some of them caught in the middle. Who exactly are the protesters now in Ferguson?
Well, I think that generally it's kind of a mixture. I think that there is a group of protesters who are there. They're peaceful. They're determined. And they're not wanting to start any violence or trouble. And I think you see a lot of them when you go to Ferguson during the day, as I have many times. I think that there's also another element that sees these restrictions that are being placed upon the protests, either a curfew or maybe restrictions about where they can go, and they just see it as a chance to defy law enforcement to the point to where there's a confrontation. There have also been reports that there are just people there who are intentionally starting certain things. I haven't been able to confirm any of that, so I want to tread carefully there. But it has been reported elsewhere. So I think that generally when you talk with people who are kind of watching it from both inside and outside, it seems like there is an element that wants to kind of be confrontational, but it's definitely not the entire group. And that has been emphasized by the governor of Missouri, Jay Nixon, many times. It's been emphasized by many of the elected officials, both city and state, who are participating in the protests. And, you know, unfortunately, though, I mean, it exists. And until they decide to not kind of engage in stuff like that you mentioned, it's going to continue potentially to be a problem, basically.
Governor Nixon has called in the National Guard. What role will they be playing in Ferguson?
I think they're going to be playing a fairly supportive role. Everything that I've heard is they're just kind of guarding a makeshift command post of sorts that all the police are in Ferguson. I don't think that right now they're going to take like an active policing role, though. We don't know. I mean, it's the first day, and as we've seen over these last few days, things have changed pretty dramatically since Saturday when Michael Brown was shot. I mean, at first there was just a multitude of police that responded to the Sunday riots where the gas station was burned and places were looted. And then St. Louis County police were kind of taken out of commission after the Wednesday night of rioting. And the Highway Patrol, which is still in charge, basically, many people thought that they had things under control after Thursday, but things kind of went awry Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to varying degrees. And I think that it just became inevitable that the National Guard was going to be brought in. Now, I think it's just a great unknown how the protesters are going to react to something like that. You know, a couple people that I talked to today feel that it may kind of provoke that you know, unfortunate element that I mentioned within that movement to lash out further. But there are other people who think that they might just bring calm to this entire situation. I mean, so far today, it's been relatively calm during the day as it is during the day in Ferguson. It's just going to be tonight where we find out what this new element to security means.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in.
Thank you very much.
That was Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. What you're hearing is the Kids from Wisconsin's performance of the song Feel the Funk. The Kids from Wisconsin is a musical performance group that brings together musical talent from around the state and tours all summer long. As they prepare to kick off their final week, we've invited them to join us here on Central Time. And joining us from our studio in Milwaukee is Ashley Payton, soprano from Muskego, also Cody Anderson, baritone from Menominee, Wisconsin, and former Kid from Wisconsin and current board member Michael Sander. Guys, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Hi.
Well, it's great to have you all here. And Ashley, I'm going to start with you. Tell us, okay, who is in this group, Kids from Wisconsin?
It's a group of 33 of us, ages 15 to 20. We have 20 singer-dancers, so 10 boys, 10 girls, and then we have a 13-piece band. It's a wide range of high school students to college students and that sort of thing. So
you've got high school students and college students. It's an interesting mix. How did that come to be, Cody?
It's pretty interesting. I mean, everyone auditions. You have to be from Wisconsin. But it's an interesting time. I mean, we kind of forget about everyone's age because we're all around each other nonstop, either on a bus or we all live together in the Tommy Thompson Youth Center at Wisconsin State Fair Park. So we kind of forget about age. So, I mean, I'm the oldest in the group. I'm 20, and I don't feel like I'm the oldest in the group sometimes.
Wait, so you live together in a youth center at State Fair Park?
There's a youth dormitory. I mean, obviously, girls stay in their own room and the guys stay in our own room. We all stay there. Sometimes when we go off to a tour that's more than a few days, sometimes the host who has us at the show site will have us do homestays with families who volunteer to house some kids, or sometimes we'll stay at like a university dorm there that will donate the rooms for us to stay in or stuff like that.
That seems pretty fun living at the State Fair. Do you perform there quite a lot? Is that why that is your home base?
Yeah, State Fair is actually one of our biggest like performance times. We're there for the whole run of State Fair, so this year was 11 days. But we're there two times a day. We also do our Kids Encore, which is kind of a little separate thing from the Kids from Wisconsin, which does like solos and trios and stuff like that we want to showcase ourselves. But that's like our main feature of where we do our summer is at the Wisconsin State Fair.
Well, Michael, let's go to you. How did the Kids from Wisconsin come into existence?
You know, it's a great story. The Kids from Wisconsin started in 1969. It was during the time when Governor Knowles, it was a turbulent time, we were at war, and Governor Knowles wanted to really feature and focus on some of Wisconsin's best things that they had to offer, which he thought were the youth. So that's how the Kids from Wisconsin were founded, through Colonel Mark Azalina, Governor Knowles, the Wisconsin State Fair Board. I know Wisconsin State Fair is one of our sponsors. And, you know, we really have been around. We want to seek out, train, showcase the musically gifted youth of Wisconsin in a manner that normally demonstrates outstanding talent, character, leadership. It's one of our greatest resources. It's our young people.
So this predates Glee. We can't look at you and say, well, this is part of the Glee effect. This has
been
around.
We are the original Glee.
Well, I want to hear some more of this. We're going to listen to a clip of one of your songs. I understand, Cody, that you're featured in this. We're going to play the clip Voodoo Daddy. Cody, what went into that one?
That's actually our dance feature called Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Out of my 3 years, that's my favorite dance feature that we've done. It's pretty intense. It's only 5 minutes long of dancing, but it feels like an hour.
Literally.
Everyone in the troupe can agree with that. It's an awesome, awesome dance feature. It kind of features everyone else in the troupe. We have, I believe, all 20 dancers dancing at one point. Our quartet that you just heard, they dance in it too. I mean, it's an awesome, awesome number. It's a lot of energy.
Ashley, what is it like being in a big group like this and doing this, you know, basically devoting your life to music and, in a sense, music theater, but all summer long?
It's a lot of fun. Obviously, a lot we wouldn't be here if we didn't love to do what we're doing and didn't have a passion for it. So it's a lot of fun to be with like-minded individuals who love this experience and love music and have a passion for all of this as much as you do. And people who are also as like at the same caliber of professionalism and talent as you are. And so it's a very unique experience to really enjoy. And it's a lot of fun. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, definitely.
Do most of the kids from Wisconsin want to go on to have professional careers in music and theater?
Not all of us, but the majority of us do. I know there's a couple of kids in the troupe this year that one of them wants to be a marine biologist, another one wants to be a doctor. But individuals like me and Cody, for instance, I'm an acting major and he's a musical theater major. So the majority of us do want to pursue a career in music or theater or some sort of somewhere in the performing arts world. But no, not necessarily. You don't have to want to do this.
So. And Cody, do you feel like it does really give you the chance to hone your craft over the summer and do something fun at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I've learned so much in my past 3 summers of just being a kid from Wisconsin. We kind of have the joke that kids' time isn't real time. A week with the kids is like 3 months in real time. It's pretty true, though. The people that they have on staff, Taras Naherniak and Carrie Hart and Jessica Foley, they are amazing people to work with. They teach us so much. And just being with the group and we learn how to go on tour and set up our equipment and actually be a touring group, it teaches us a lot about like perseverance and like just really focusing on ourselves and on each other and working together with a team.
And Cody, I understand this is your last year with the group. How are you feeling? Is it sad?
Yes, it is very, very bittersweet. I'm excited to like move on and maybe look at some other stuff.
And what does that mean? What will you be doing?
I'm looking at a few amusement parks, maybe Valley Fair or Six Flags. I'm looking at Holiday World in Indiana. But it's kind of sad. It's our last week with the kids, and the emotions are kind of getting there, but yeah. Still focusing on the shows.
Well, maybe it's a good time to play a happy piece of music.
Absolutely.
That we just so happen to have right here. This is Happy by Pharrell Williams. Okay, well, hopefully that picked you up, Cody.
Oh, it did.
Michael, I want to go to you and say if someone was considering joining the Kids from Wisconsin, and you've seen it from a couple different angles as a board member, as a member of the group itself, what would you say that people come away from after they've joined it? What do they have with them?
Do you know, I realized as I get older how important this group was and all the learning experience that I got out of it and life skills. It wasn't just performing. Even though I went on performing professionally, I honed those skills with the kids. There's just a lot of communication skills that you're going to utilize in all your life. Communication, learning to work as a team. I mean, it's a really educational, intense program beyond the music. You know, we always focus on the music, but as Ashley was stating before, not everybody goes into music. We're just really wanting to make well-rounded citizens, who give back to the community. And I think we've been doing that for years, and I think we're going to continue that.
Do most people who are members of Kids from Wisconsin, do they go on to keep music in their life in some form, even if it doesn't mean performing every summer, but do they keep music in their lives?
I think so. I have a lot of friends from the past. I was a kid from Wisconsin 20 years ago. There are some of those kids who are still performing professionally, whether they're on cruise lines or they are performing on Broadway. I mean, they go on to do great feats, but then there's some who take a step back, but music is always a part of their life. They may be in a band, part-time. I know I like to still sing in the shower.
Well, that counts. That's fair. So what have you got on tap? You said this is the last week coming up. What performances do you have real quick?
Do you know, I really want to push we have a show tomorrow at the Stephanie Wheel Center in Sheboygan. Normally kids from Wisconsin are hired from different fundraisers for different companies or different schools. charities. But the kids from Wisconsin, we're doing our own show where we're actually underwriting it. And it's in Sheboygan at the Wheel Center tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. And it's one of our fundraisers. It's one of our only fundraisers beyond getting our major revenue from our performance fees. So it's an exciting time. It's a great theater, and we're just excited to bring the show to Sheboygan, and hopefully we can build up our audience. There's a few seats left, so get out there and get some tickets.
Great. Well, I wish you all well. We've been speaking with Ashley Payton, Cody Anderson, and Michael Sander of the musical group The Kids from Wisconsin. They've been singing and dancing around the state this summer and are headed into their final week of performances. As we heard, they'll be at the Weill Center for the Performing Arts in Sheboygan tomorrow night at 7:30. Making the transition from the teenage years to adulthood isn't easy for anyone, but as tough as it can be even more confusing for someone living with Asperger's syndrome, where social cues often aren't very clear. That was the story of our next guest, who traveled that bumpy road and lived to tell about it, and now he's written a book for those who might be in a similar position, with advice on how to handle things like that first job and surviving the world of online dating. Well, joining us now is Jesse Saperstein. He's an author, speaker, and autism advocate. His new book is called Getting a Life with Asperger's: Lessons Learned on the Bumpy Road to Adulthood. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and may you please repeat your name so I pronounce it correctly on the air?
Absolutely. Veronica Rickert is my name.
Veronica Rickert. Nice to meet you.
You as well. Well, Jesse, reading through your book, there's a lot of good advice for young adults, whether or not they have Asperger's, but you're focused on the ones that do. What makes this time of life especially hard for someone with Asperger's?
Well, with Asperger's, people are often affected socially, so they may be extremely intelligent, but this intelligence does not often earn them the jobs and opportunities they deserve, because they're so behind in many ways socially. And a lot of this can be solved with education and resolving misunderstandings.
So how do you do that? How do you go about, for instance, resolving misunderstandings?
Well, as the title of my book suggests, I learned everything through the school of hard knocks with lingering suffering. And every time there was a misunderstanding, I just wanted to scream at the top of my lungs, God, if you had only told me about this issue 6 months ago, I could have done something about it. And I always tell people, actually everyone should tell people this, we cannot fix something if we don't know what's broken. So my idea is to be honest about one's condition and talk about some of the assets that we'll bring to the table, and also some common misunderstandings that are not that big of a deal if they're addressed.
And one thing that it seems like you advocate doing is just for the person with Asperger's syndrome to just let people know that they have Asperger's syndrome and they might need clearer communication, or, you know, to talk through things. Would you say that's a good piece of advice?
That's a great piece of advice, Veronica. And there's an essay in my new book called Getting a Life with Asperger's about disclosure. And it's all about the fine art of telling why you're special and how to navigate the social quagmires. And I think that when you tell people you have Asperger's, you're not using it as an excuse. At the beginning, I would only disclose if I got into trouble, kind of hoping to alleviate the punishment. But now it's just a matter of saying, I want to do better, and with communication, I can achieve if given the chance.
Well, can you walk us through that moment? Let's say you're a young adult with Asperger's, you're getting, you know, your first real job. What is a good way to approach sharing some of what you're talking about with your employer?
When you go to an interview, you do not say, I have Asperger's, and this means I'll be accused of stalking, most likely. I'll have a lot of trouble with getting my work done on time. You want to be as positive as you can, and also explain that basically if issues are brought to the table, then you'll do well in the job. And how I've succeeded is every time I have a good experience at a job, I will ask the employer to write a recommendation, and I'll keep that in a very safe place. So whenever doubts are experienced about my case of Asperger's, I bring out this whole library of excellent recommendations, where I've been successful at a funeral home, working as an assistant funeral director, and many other venues where plenty of people would have failed, Asperger's or not.
Well, one thing that you talk about in the book that can be an incredible strength is that you say that you and many people with Asperger's are incredibly tenacious. You'll stick with something.
Yes, and that tenacity, that bulldog relentlessness, can be both a good and bad thing. It helped me get through the Appalachian Trail, which is over 2,000 miles with no hiking experience. But with things involving human emotions, such as, say, online dating, it worked in the absolute opposite, meaning that it brought catastrophe. So I think that one's strength can become a weakness and vice versa. And as people get older, they understand when to be tenacious and when to put something on a back burner.
What would you say that someone with Asperger's does bring to a job that someone else may not?
I worked with some incredible organizations, and in one of them, I think it's done by Cornell University, but they had this young man with Asperger's, and he applied for a job at a pharmacy. And within days, the manager was calling the organization, telling about how incredible this employee was, that they were diligent, they had no interest in stealing the medication, that had an extremely high street value, and they were just focused on the task at hand. And for the most part, we're extremely honest, and this can be a bad thing, like when we meet somebody and we haven't seen them for a long time and the years have not been so kind to them, to put it mildly. But there's also the good kind of honesty where you return lost wallets and other things that people lose.
And would you say that most people at this point know what Asperger's syndrome is?
I think that in many ways they do, Veronica, but at the same time they don't understand exactly what it is. They may know that it's associated with the autism spectrum disorder, but they don't know the strengths and the misunderstandings that occur. And most important, they don't know how mild it is sometimes, because when people think of autism, they think of a very prominent disability. But sometimes it's so mild that it resembles a character flaw, flaw, or somebody being obnoxious.
Well, let's talk about that, because early on in your book, you say you finally get a diagnosis from a doctor who says, Jesse, you have Asperger's syndrome. And what that is, it's the lowest rung on the ladder of the autism spectrum. How would you define it today?
I would define it as just a social difference that creates some issues, but overall, people can succeed if they're allowed the right resources. And a lot of the disablers associated with my disability have little to do with the autism spectrum. They have to do with the repeated mistakes that are not corrected through the right intervention, fear of failure. You know, there's a lot of people who have Asperger's and they go on disability simply because they don't want to take the chances of going after a job and failing and other setbacks that happen. So, and also, I'd say that there's an essay in my book called The Road Out of Loserville, which deals with people getting into slumps. And that usually occurs, that often occurs during transitional periods.
And what happens during a slump where you're between jobs and it sounds like self-esteem can be a problem both for you and other people with Asperger's? How do you get out of that cycle of maybe feeling bad about yourself?
Well, the answer is I compare it to this metaphor of when I was on the Appalachian Trail. I was in this lean-to, which is basically an open shelter, and there was a swarm of mosquitoes because it was right by a swamp, and I desperately tried to cover my head and burrow into the sleeping bag like a mummy, and they still found their way in, and I was freaking out. And finally, I realized this is not going to stop, and I kept hiking. I just left the shelter at 1 o'clock in the morning and hiked all night long, and they had no chance of catching up to me. So what I'm trying to say is that it seems our biggest problems occur during periods of inertia when we have too much idle time. So your question is, what do you do in a slump? You just try to keep moving, and no matter how ridiculously menial the accomplishment is that day, you celebrate it, even if it's cleaning your room or something. So, and also, we have trouble during transitions because all of a sudden things change and no one gives us the memo.
And what about seeking mental health, because health care, because you say that something that's common to a lot of people with Asperger's, it's that they carry a lot of emotional scars from their life, people being cruel to them, coming of age in a time where bullying was sort of left unchecked. What do you do when you've got those scars and then you can't quite get rid of them on your own?
Well, that's an excellent question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that ever. So it's so important to understand that part of the syndrome for many people is the inability to move on and let go. And a lot of people say, well, people without Asperger's have that trouble. But I think that for many other people without autism, they eventually get to that point. But for me, there is no eventually. I don't really move on or let go. Therefore, I think it helps to compromise and put something on a back burner. But with my obstacles, I can say that if I did not go through this bitterness, the sometimes unrelenting bullying, what would I have to write about? I'd have no books, and I would not be helping others. So no matter how horrific the scars may be, you can find a channel for them, and others will help you if they care about those with Asperger's.
Well, we're talking right now with autism advocate and author Jesse Saperstein about making the transition to adulthood when you have Asperger's. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a young adult with Asperger's or the parent of one, what questions do you have? Do you have a story to tell about what it was like? If you're an adult with Asperger's who's been down this road, what was your experience like? And what do you wish you knew back then that you know now? 800-642-1234 is the number, 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Jesse Saperstein, author of the new book, Getting a Life with Asperger's, Lessons Learned on the Bumpy Road to Adulthood. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. If you're a young adult with Asperger's or maybe the parent of one, what practical advice would help you? Or if you're an adult with Asperger's who's been down this road, what was that experience like and what advice can you offer? 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Jesse, I want to talk about a situation that seems like it's kind of filled with landmines for people with Asperger's, dating and then online dating. What is different for people with Asperger's when they try to enter the dating scene?
For Asperger's, there's many times when they're not able to read the hidden signals. And back when I tried online dating, people said the word no in a variety of ways, and usually it was without actually saying the word. It was with eliminating phone calls, not answering the phone, and using ambivalent messages like, we'll see, I'm busy this month. And of course, they expect the other person to get the message, but it's a lot harder for someone on the autism spectrum.
So what advice would you have about how to handle yourself?
I always promised myself that I would never give anybody advice I'd never be able to handle myself. So I'm not going to tell people to let it go immediately. What I will say is try what's called incremental backing off, which means that you don't sever the connection, but you may call again in the month or 2 weeks, and eventually you may want to say, I have Asperger's, and it's really hard for me to sometimes understand when someone is interested or not. But for the most part, I just tell people that dating is all about moving on and letting go, whether it's fair or not. That's just the way society is. And if someone has, if someone wants to be left alone, then that's their legal and human right, regardless of how unfair it may seem.
So tips for, you know, doing what can be really difficult for anybody, and that is letting go of someone that you might be attached to. So that sounds like something that's more difficult. Is that something that was hard for you to learn?
It was extremely hard. And another thing that was also hard was understanding the rules beneath the rules, meaning the things that people don't tell you in black and white. You have to either figure it out for yourself or learn it the hard way. And unfortunately, I was the recipient of several stalking allegations in my community. And it was never like the Glenn Close rabbit boiling in the pot type of deal. It was more like a misunderstanding that always escalated out of control. One of several examples is there was a young lady at a local CVS, and she was always very kind to me. She would confide in me about some of her personal problems. And I thought that it seemed like a good idea to ask her out twice in a year-long period, and that itself created a truckload of problems. So it's all about also knowing that you should not really try to pursue your coworkers. I mean, there has to be at least one compatible person out of the multi-millions of people in this country who you don't work with.
Right. All right, well, let's go to Jess, who's joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Jess.
Hi. I was recently diagnosed with Asperger's in my mid-40s, and this is apparently after a lifetime of growing up with it, never knowing or even hearing about it. But somebody suggested it had an effect on my marriage and my family and so on. And I normally get two reactions. One is either the light bulb goes off in people's minds and they say, oh, well, that explains a lot. Or two, the denial aspect of it. There's no way, you're too extroverted, and there's no way you can have it.
Right. So have you figured out how to navigate those waters, Jess?
I'm still in the process of learning and figuring it out now.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And just describing what's, you know, can be a long, long path of discovery, sometimes whether the diagnosis comes earlier or later. Is this something, Jesse, that you think you'll be learning about your entire life?
Yes, I think that it's really hard, Jeff, to go through 40 years of your life and all of a sudden it's explained why you were a certain way and why your marriage may have failed. But my advice is to not put yourself at the mercy of other people's reactions. And I mean, unless they have a master's in psychology, you really should not take their opinions too seriously. You'll drive yourself absolutely crazy. And some people may think that you're excusing bouts of quasi-inappropriate conduct. And just to avoid that misunderstanding, you should let them know that your diagnosis is to help you do better and understand the way your mind works, what you need from society to help.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate that, Jeff. And we're gonna go now to Joyce in Portage. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. How are you?
Doing
well.
Hi,
Joyce.
Hi. I have a question because I've been realizing that we have a lot of this running through our family. We have several members of the family who have self-medicated them in ways that they probably wouldn't have had to had they had a diagnosis and understood it a little more. But now I have a 22-year-old who, for all practical purposes, is an adult. And oftentimes when I'm attempting to help or to understand or want to sidle up and get close and try to be the friend she needs me to be, she just closes the door and wants to be left alone.
Okay, so Joyce, your question there is how to help someone and give them your support when they seem to push you away and want to be alone. What would you say to that, Jesse?
Well, that sounds not just Asperger's. That sounds like a typical 22-year-old woman. I think that, how do you try to help Joyce?
I just want to find out what's bothering her or if there's anything I can do to help. But a lot of the time she just basically says, that I don't understand. And she used to be a really studious, good grade. She would read 2 or 3 books a month. Somehow that's kind of gotten lost, and now I think she's telling me that because I never that things were bad with her when she was younger, that I have no right to know about it now.
All right. Well, that sounds difficult, Jesse. It sounds like her daughter's having a rough time.
Is your daughter going through a transitional period where she's between college and graduate school or a full-time career?
Yeah. She was going to junior college and get a prerequisites accomplished, and then she had a brief amount of time where she moved out, got her own apartment, and thought that she'd like to be independent, met someone, and didn't meet someone who was very good for her to be with, and is sort of rebounding from that. But she's scheduled to get back to school now this fall semester, so she's recognized that, you know, she kind of went awry, and I'm thankful for that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling, Joyce. We appreciate that. Jesse, any final bits of advice for Joyce before we move on?
Yes, the fact that this is a transitional period is definitely why she's having these troubles. So I think that things may resolve themselves when she returns to college, but I'm wondering, maybe she's holding on to some bitterness of times when you have not understood, or you've offered criticism that seemed harsh, or maybe she feels you did not stand up for her when other relatives passed harsh judgment. And of course, you did not know what you were dealing with. And maybe you can broach the subject by saying, I'm sorry that I probably did not give you enough support, but I did not understand how special you are. And I want to understand now. And I just want to help you be happy. And maybe if you make it about her happiness and focus on all of her positive qualities, then that will make a dramatic difference.
Well, Jesse, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. And may I give the readers my webpage?
Sure.
It is www.jessesaperstein, JesseSaperstein.com. And you can order books through the website if you want messages inside. And I look forward to hearing from some of your viewers.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Jesse Saperstein with us there. He's the author of Getting a Life with Asperger's.